This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and today Eleanor Higginbotham is here with us. She is the scholar on Emily Dickinson in this country, and she's going to tell us about Emily Dickinson. And I would like to just begin by saying, who is Emily Dickinson, and why is she America's icon?
First of all, I'm one of about 400 scholars. There's an industry on Emily Dickinson. I like to think I've cornered the market on one little angle on her, but I love her, and she's my life. I sort of am Emily, and for many, many hours of my life, but not in this respect. The biblical biography of her, Richard Sewell, begins, the word genius is the first word in the book. So I would start with that she's considered a genius. She's considered our first modern poet. She's considered the first radically revising a form person by Alicia Ostreicher. At the same time, she has these roots that go back to Calvinism. She knew her Bible. She fought against it. She fought against God a lot of the time. She was a member of the first family of Amherst.
Her father started the time.
Yes.
The historical time.
Her grandfather began Amherst College, and it ruined him financially, which was always a sort of dark thing in the background of the family. But her father was on the board, and of course it succeeded. And so she was in the first family. Her father was a judge, and he was later, as you I'm sure know, a representative in the House of Representatives here in Washington. And you know, to follow the daily events. She was a friend of all important people in her day, editors, one of whom she might have had a romance with, the leading clergyman. Great people were on her epistolary list. And so she was not what myth has her cut away from the world. She did, after a particular period in her life, famously decide she'd rather stay at home with her garden and her sister and her father and mother than waste her time, that's my interpretation, than waste her time with coffee klatches and trivial things that other women of her period might have become involved with. She's not the only female writer of the century. I mean, Harriet Beecher Stowe is writing at the same time. And there are many, many women
in
Walt Whitman. But among women, I'm, you know, talking about, she's not a trailblazer in that way, because there are many women making a lot of money on their poetry. Women like Lydia Sigourney, who had to, you know, feed the family. So she's not in that camp. And I think because there were these women who were in the marketplace was not something she needed. And it was not something she desired. She was fearful of having her poems tampered with, I think. So when the few times they were published, some of the times, there were about 11 published in her lifetime, some of them she probably did agree to. They were published in a magazine called Drumbeat that supported the Union forces. But others were, quote-unquote, robbed of her. One in particular is kind of funny because it's a poem that I bet was in your high school anthology. A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rides. You may have met him, did you not? His notice sudden is, and so forth. And it's a riddle poem because she didn't title her poems. Very, very seldom did she title a poem. So this one is a riddle. And when it works right, when you have a classroom, say, or a room full of people who don't know Emily Dickinson, don't know these stories, and you read the poem together, there are all kinds of ideas on what it is. But when it was robbed of her and printed in the Springfield Republican, it had a big title, The Snake. So the joke was spoiled. And she was, you know, upset about that, rightly so. So what she did instead, and you can cut me off at any time, what she did instead of entering the marketplace the way other people did, to great benefit.
Yes.
You know, because Hawthorne was very angry with the women. He called them the damned mob of scribbling women. They were making more money than he was.
Well, we have so much project to learn from you. But some of this is your view, because some others hold other views about her seclusion. Sure. Eleanor Higginbotham, and she is here today as the author of two books. One is Dwelling in Possibilities, and this is the reading of the fascicles, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
That is your...
That's my project.
That's your field, the fascicles.
Yes.
And this one is Dickinson's Fascicles, A Spectrum of Possibilities. And these are, I think this is coming out in paperback.
Yes.
It
yes.
has
I'm
already.
I'm very pleased that it has already come out. These are both Ohio State University Press, which lovely press to work with. And the essays came about because this is a highly contested area, what Dickinson meant with these little books. I said she didn't enter the marketplace, but she did do something even more remarkable. She folded pieces of paper, and you can see here.
I can.
And stacked them and stabbed them with a big thread. And then it's not, I used to picture before I actually saw one of these and saw the thread, I pictured the almost like a sewing machine kind of binding. But no, it's more like a twine that you'd wrap your roast in. It's a heavy twine. And she literally and figuratively threaded the poems together. And the reason for the disagreement, the contest in the field, is that when these were reassembled finally in the 1970s by Ralph Franklin, he said in his introduction, he's a great man in the field, great man. He said that these were scrapbooks so that she wouldn't lose her things. And he also said that occasionally she would forget and repeat a poem in another little book. They held between 17 and 23 poems each. Mm-hmm. So they were really what
little
we would call a chapbook.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But they were hand printed, you know,
hand
that was the
written.
Ink.
Yes.
And when you see them, the paper is fine usually. The ink is wet. It must have been very hard, and she had to be very deliberate to write on these. I mean, she chose carefully.
But they were the revised versions, probably.
Well, they were, and very often they were among several copies that she had. She would copy poems and send them to friends. About a quarter of her poems were sent to friends and were published in that way because they were out in the world and thus got republished sometimes.
And they did tamper with the fascicles and the punctuation at
yes.
one point, didn't they?
And
now they've been restored.
Yes.
Would you describe what an Emily Dickinson poem might look like?
It has dashes. It's a dashy poem. That's the main Emily Dickinson mark. First of all, the lineation, although her meter is probably mostly 8-6-8-6, which is a hymn meter. The way she lineates it on the page very often makes it look more modern. And sometimes she is much more modern. Sometimes she's much more E.E. Cummings than the Watts hymn book. But she's both. She's modern and she's traditional.
I would love it if you would give us a taste of it. This is Eleanor Higginbotham, and she is an authority on the fascicles, and she is going to tell us so much we need to know. But we would love to hear a taste. Something by Emily, and then perhaps you would talk about that poem and why it's important.
I will. And first of all, I have to tell you my surprise for you.
Okay.
Emily Dickinson died on May 15th, 1886. Her funeral, at which Thomas Wentworth Higginson, the great man of the century, read Bronte, was May 19th, 1886. And as we're talking today, it's May 19th. So this is it couldn't be an accident, can it? That months and months ago, we chose this date. And I just realized last night, it sent shivers up my spine that this is almost, you know, a seance.
This is divination. We have been divinized.
I know. And one of my essay in that book of essays, by the way, the essay book, this is moving from the poem.
Which one is the essay book?
This is the essay book.
Spectrum of possibilities.
Yes, it's called a spectrum because I argue strenuously for reading the poems in their fascicle context, which we can now do with this brand new book. They're not published that way for the usual reader's editions. And so I argue strongly for that. And I also argue that the context of that little chapbook, if you want to call it that fascicle, shapes our interpretation of a given poem, what its opposite whether it's first or last, what the other poems between
just like
it
any
are.
Any book, though.
Yeah, exactly.
The juxtaposition of poems.
And she's the one that chose that. So therefore, that's really her contextual home for those poems. So when people take them out, and we all do, you know, we all put all of the death poem, or, you know, 20 death poems together, or 20 B poems together, and we take them out and shuffle them around like cards or something, or we make them tell a story of obsession or desire or something. But the way she intended them to be read, probably, I think, is this. But there are a spectrum of possibilities for ways to interpret that. And not everybody agrees that this is, you know, that there we necessarily need to read a pattern. And one of the most sort of sharp critiques of that is that the song may not be on the page, but in our head, our way of interpreting what the context is. That's true of any you know, critical.
So there will be no end of scholarship.
Exactly.
On this, really.
Exactly.
And you have your own strong viewpoints, and you've published them. And now you're holding a new book in your hand.
And this is brand new.
And it looks like it weighs about 5 pounds.
It's not as heavy as the 3 volumes of the, if you buy either the Franklin or the, you asked about the old way of her appearance of poems with normal punctuation, some normal rhymes and so forth. They were tinkered with. Up until 1955, when Thomas Johnson, another great scholar, did the initial Variorum in 3 volumes, and then it came out in a reader's edition. And most of us who teach have used that one until about 20 years ago, when a man named Ralph Franklin brought out a new Variorum. But just like last month, this book came out, and Christiane Miller, a terrific scholar in our field, one of these hundreds of people in this industry, but a major, major one, has done what I have said ever since I first started working on this, that, oh my goodness, we need a publication that we can use in classrooms that show Emily Dickinson's placement of the poems. So she has done this by placing all of the poems in their fascicle context. My only quibble with it is that if you look at this page, I'm going to read you, if you don't mind, 2 poems, because they're not too long.
We would like that.
And they look at the way they answer each other across the page. But the way Harvard asked her to do this, you know, she's saving space, so that you don't get the sense of these across the page, because the first one comes on this page, and then you have to turn the page. And you can see here that they answer each other. And when you do see that they answer each other, It's absolutely fascinating.
That is significant, I think.
I think so, too, and I think she would have, you know,
objected,
liked
perhaps.
This.
Well, let us hear one.
Okay, the first one is Naughty Poem. They shut me up in prose, as when a little girl, they put me in a closet because they liked me still, in quotations, still, could themselves have peeped and seen my brain go round, they might as well have lodged a bird for treason in the pound. Himself, the bird, has but to will, and easy as a star look down upon captivity and laugh. No more have I. So that's about a little girl they're trying to silence by putting her in some kind of a closet. Opposite that is the poem that's a declaration of Emersonian thought about what a poet is. So opposite being shut up in prose is, this was a poet. It is that distills amazing sense from ordinary meanings and atter, so immense from the familiar species that perished by the door, we wonder it was not ourselves arrested it before. Of pictures, the discloser, the poet, it is he entitles us by contrast to ceaseless poverty. Of portion so unconscious, the robbing could not harm himself to him, a fortune exterior to time. So both are great poems. One is sort of playful. One is very serious. It's an Ars Poetica. But when you look at them across the page, you see that Emily Dickinson was not of individual poems, but they liked her still. He's the discloser, The poet is the discloser, makes us unstill.
Is it that way in every fascicle,
it's
on every
very
page?
Often. I have another example, which is about two poems, where there are two poems facing each other. It's in another fascicle. And in one poem, she's talking about Moses not being able to get into the promised land or seeing the Canaan. And in the other poem, it's about the wonderful poem about poems. I hold a faded letter to the light. It's about how you get all trembly when you get an antique letter out of a box, an ebon box, when lives are gone. You know, you lift this dusty letter and you scan and con the contents of it the way Moses scanned the promised land, so that a letter, a text, is literally opposite on the page to the notion of a promised land.
I understand those two examples, but I wonder if this is your view or is it shared by many?
Well, see, that's what this, I named the conflict. Is it that I just happen to see that way and interpret it that way? Sure, I happen to see it. But she also gives us a little clue that she wants us to dig around, you know? She talks about the poem or the flower wandering down the latitudes until it comes to continents away. And what then, she says? Only your inference therefrom. So that's what we do with poetry. We, you know, we look at the words on the page, we con them, we scan them, we see what literally is there, little girl locked in a closet, or, you know, a description of all the things Emerson said a poet is, a distiller, richer than anybody because he has imagination and so forth. And you can see that literally on the page. But then you can also, if you're kind of, as I think, if you're alert to things, if you're really reading and looking, especially at the manuscripts, you see things that I can't believe she didn't want us to see. Now, she may have surprised herself. In some cases, what I see and what she meant, when you get into the dangerous, you know, intentional fallacy and so forth, and what she intended and what we perceive are, of course,
I would love to take a course of yours. I have to tell everyone who you are, Eleanor Hagenbotham. She has been teaching Emily Dickinson for many years. She is the author of these two books on Dickinson's fascicles. She originally went to the College of Worcester, and then she accompanied her foreign service husband to Liberia, Vietnam, Indonesia, and teaching everywhere, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then when at home, you received your PhD from College Park in Maryland.
Late life degree,
but you have used it well. And then she has used her career studying and teaching and writing. Have you been writing on Fitzgerald also?
A little bit.
And Wilder?
And a lot of other people. Like I wrote an essay for a collection on the women of the beat movement, if you can believe it.
I can't get much farther away. Because Emily was pretty beat. I mean, she was pretty hot.
We must say that she was born in
1830.
Yes.
And that's very important.
Yes.
Because when we think of the innovation, and for her to be so unique and have the courage to be who she was without precedent, that is, I guess, one of the astonishments. Eleanor, tell us something else that you have found in your studies that surprised you greatly.
I think her family dynamic is so interesting. I mean, there are people who spend a career and books sleuthing like the romances, the potential romances, because there are three
fantastic master and lesser.
Well, one is a minister, Charles Wadsworth. He was a contender early on.
But she just met him once, right?
She met him a couple of times. She went to his church in Philadelphia. A whole bunch of Dickinsonians went into that church. It's a Presbyterian church. And the only thing we wanted to see was the picture of him on the wall. There is an appeal about that because she loved words so much and he was a great preacher. And she was struggling with her faith. And he, you know, part of the correspondence that they had was that she was worried about her relationship with, you know, whether to accept what her culture told her to accept or not. But the another candidate, and a very strong one, and one that a wonderful writer, a real truly great scholar, Judith Farr, kind of puts her money on, if there is one, if there is a master, is the editor of the Springfield Republic, who is in and out of the House all the time, a very great man in his own right. And there are about four or five other contenders for that, including her sister-in-law, Sue, because there is the line, and it's a very strong one, that that feels that many of the letters and the poems have lesbian readings to them.
Let's hear the members of her family.
Yes, so we have her grandfather, and so for very prominent. Her father, the judge, the representative, she said his heart was very pure and terrible, and I think none like it exists when he died. And Barbara Mossberg has a whole book about the father-daughter, when a poet is a daughter, and it's a fascinating, you know, sort of stamping her foot at her father and so forth. But she had a teasing relationship with him. And you see that in The Belle of Amherst, and I think it's in the letter she writes to her brother about her father, that she dared to tease him. She was so glad. She loved him so much. She was so glad that on the day that he died, that he would die, she had been with him at breakfast. Of course, she was heartbroken, and that comment, his heart was very pure and terrible, was something she said later. Her mother came from the Norcross family, which was a big family in education in a nearby town. And the husband and wife, the parents of the three children-to-be, talked about how they would raise their children, including daughters, before they were even married. And they talked about their faith. And those letters have been collected by Vivian Pollack. Fascinating, the dynamic. And because Emily Dickinson told Thomas Wentworth Higginson, this great man I spoke about, that she said, "I've never had a mother. I suppose a mother is someone to whom you turn when you are in trouble." It's a terrible lie to tell. And she lied to Higginson all the time. I mean, she wrote him her description of herself, and she said, "I'm small like the wren," you know, and so forth. She wasn't that small. And she said, "I've written but, you know, a few poems," and she'd written hundreds already. So she teased with him, too, this great man. And so she said that about her mother. But in reality, she nursed her mother. Her mother had a stroke at a fairly young age, and she and the sister who stayed at home with her, I'll tell in a minute about her, nursed their mother, and she loved her mother. And the letters that she wrote to the cousins she was very close to reveal a tremendous heartbreak. And her mother was a very intelligent woman, obviously, ran this household and had these bright children. Her older brother, Austin, was a character, flamboyant. And, of course, it was no secret to anybody in the town that he had a wild affair with the wife of a professor. And it was very well documented. This is not secret stuff that the Inquirer had to dig out. It's in the court records. And so it was in all the papers. So he was very bright. He was also a trustee. He was his father's son. An idiosyncratic person. He died, I think, of exhaustion because he was between this beautiful woman of whom he was enamored and his strong wife, the other powerful character in the story, Susan, whom he married, Emily's best friend.
Yes.
With whom she may or may not have been in love, but whom she had the closest mm-hmm. of relationships with, mm-hmm. occasionally cooled off, but, you know, really a passionate affair. I use that in the broadest term, but she loved her, and she was so glad that they married, although there was, you know, some of the poems reveal all kinds of psychodynamics in there. And then she had a younger sister. So there's the older brother. She's in the middle. She had a younger sister who was also very colorful. She loved cats, and she had boyfriends, and she was vain, and you know, she was sort of the one who did. She said, "Emily has to think. She has that to do." So she, who bought the paper probably and the ink for the household and knew what her sister was doing, allowed her sister to do that because she took probably a little more of the household chores. Emily did cook, but, you know, her participation was not that great because they had an Irish helper, very important person. It's a wonderful book about her, The Maid as Muse. So there are all these characters in the household, and they're the ones that, who are coming in and out, and the places where she, you know, the people she loved. And there are three volumes of letters. There are as many letters as there are poems, and they are as wonderful reading and also deeply sad letters. It's the range, the gamut of emotion. And you can only imagine someone getting a letter from Emily Dickinson and saying, as she said, all men say, what, to me? You know, and you read a poem and you say, what?
Eleanor Higginbotham, you know, there has to be so much invested in Emily that you have learned something about yourself in this journey. What is it that you think you have found out and discovered in this immersion, this beautiful lifelong immersion into the scholarship of Emily Dickinson? What changed you?
Well, certainly the power of a word. I mean, she was very concerned. She read her lexicon. She talked about words, and she has whole poems about words, and carelessly used or carefully used. You know, that the power of that, the power of the word, the power of a poem to change a life. There's a whole collection of essays on Emily Dickinson changing, rescuing people from various troubles that they had. But for me, raised as I was, I think the thought that it's all right to wrestle with God. It's all right, this wrestling match we have with what is handed down to us. She did it her whole life. I think in the end, she deeply, deeply wanted to believe what she was told. She couldn't do it at 14. She said, I will be one of the bad ones. You know, like Cordelia, she couldn't heave into her mouth something she couldn't put in formulaic terms back. But that's a mark of how much she cared about this relationship, the most profound relationship. You know, she asked a clergyman, is what they say true about immortality? Mm. That was her most important question, the flood subject.
The poems are full of it.
And yes. And so, you know, that's the ultimate question, especially when you get to be our ages.
And you were the daughter of a very, very famous Presbyterian minister who ministered to presidents of the United States.
Yes, yes.
So I see how you can understand her position.
Yes.
That she was born into this Calvinistic Protestant idea, and yet the crisis of faith is always with those who are truly faithful.
Yes.
But before we end, would you read us two more of your favorites?
I will. This is when, I don't know if you noticed that my signature on an email is I dwell in possibility.
Right.
Of course, this is one of the most famous. They're wonderful, odd poems I could read, but this is so wonderful. I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose, more numerous of windows, superior for doors, of chambers as the cedars, impregnable of eye, and for an everlasting roof, the gambrels of the sky. A visitor's the fairest, for occupation this. The spreading wide my narrow hands to gather paradise.
We are talking to Eleanor Higginbotham, and this is The Poet and the Poem at the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter-Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reeva and David Logan Foundation. Additional support from Avi Deshashani and Ken McNeil. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.